Well, good morning and welcome back from the break. I want to express my gratitude to the organizers for putting together such a nice workshop and for the opportunity to tell you about some of the work that we've been doing at the Advanced Light Source at the Berkeley Lab. I'm going to focus on X-ray spectroscopy of solvated transmetal complexes and oxide materials. This is, I guess, sort of start of this transition toward looking at condensed matter spectroscopy. There's a number of talks tomorrow and I think on Friday applying X-ray techniques to look at condensed matter. Just a very general sort of motivation for what we're doing. We really want to try to understand how properties of matter emerge from correlated motion of electrons and the coupling between atomic and electronic structure. And the two areas that I'm going to try to focus on are on molecular systems. And the ones that are of particular interest are ones that are not well described by simple adiabatic potential energy surfaces. Systems where strong coupling gives rise to a breakdown in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and you really can't separate the evolution of the electronic and nuclear wave functions. And sort of the complement to this in hard condensed matter are in electronic systems that are not well described by single electron band structure models. Systems where you have strong coupling between charge, orbital, spin, and lattice degrees of freedom, and that sort of coupling gives rise to exotic properties that there's a compelling interest to understand. So again, I'm referring to valence electronic structure in terms of energy levels, charge distribution, bonding, and spin, and of course atomic structures, atomic arrangements, and bond distances. And the interest here in ultrafast measurements is that they give us a new window to sort of separate out these sort of correlated and coupled phenomena in the time domain. So we have at least some chance to observe these properties and these correlations as they develop. And of course, to date, this has largely been the domain of optical spectroscopy. And there's a rich field of ultrafast optical spectroscopy with high time resolution going down to a few cycle pulses. Of course, the advantage of X-rays is that they can give us more quantitative information about this sort of electronic structure. This sort of motivation slide is hardly necessary for an audience like this. I'm going to focus mostly on X-ray spectroscopy techniques. That can give us important information about electronic structure, techniques like extended X-ray absorption fine structure, where you're looking at above a core level absorption. The fine structure and the absorption is a direct indication of interatomic distances. In a near edge region, you're probing valence states from core levels of well-defined energy and symmetry, and so you can get quantitative information about the valence electronic structure by these core level probes. Of course, dichroism techniques give you information about magnetization and spin and allow you to separate orbital and spin contributions to the net magnetic moment. And these are very powerful techniques for looking at systems that don't exhibit long-range order, solvated molecules being one example that I'll talk about. They're also powerful for looking at interfaces and complex and disordered materials. So that's sort of the focus. I will say a little bit about some current work that we're focusing on using diffraction techniques, but in this case, it's really resonant diffraction. And so in that sense, it's really another example of spectroscopy. So this is sort of an outline. First talk about work we've been doing in solvated transition metal complexes, where we're looking at the atomic structure, but more recently looking at the electronic structure by probing at the iron L edge in these systems to understand the influence of the ligands and the dynamic change in ligand bonding on the electronic structure. We've been doing some experiments in looking at hydrogen bonding in liquid water. I'm not going to talk about that. But then I'll talk about another related topic, also transition metal complexes, in this case, hard condensed matter, colossal magnetoresistive manganites, where you can actually manipulate these properties in the electronic ground state by vibrationally pumping specific, in this case, manganese oxygen stretching modes. In our initial efforts to try to understand what's going on in the electronic structure, using time-resolved Zanes techniques, absorption spectroscopy at the oxygen K edge, and now starting to do resonant X-ray diffraction to look at charge and orbital ordering under the influence of these ultrafast optical excitations. So the work I'm going to describe has been done at the Advanced Light Source. I'll just say a few words about the system that we're using. This is a technique that we have and dedicated beam lines for time-resolved spectroscopy, where we're using femtosecond laser pulses to manipulate electrons in the storage ring. So the nominal 50 to 70 picosecond pulse durations that you get out of synchrotrons can be pushed down to the few hundred femtosecond timescale by essentially extracting a slice of the electrons and using that slice of electrons to generate femtosecond X-ray pulses. Of course, you pay a huge penalty in terms of flux, so this doesn't really compare to free electron laser sources, but we have now two operating beam lines at the ALS that have tunability in the soft X-ray range from about 200 eV up to 2 kilovolts. And then the hard X-ray range from about 2 to 10 kilovolts. So there, it becomes a very useful tool for this range of spectroscopy techniques that I'll be discussing in the talk. So first, a quick introduction to these spin crossover molecules and why they're of interest. So these are transition metal complexes with octahedral, in this case, pyridyl ligands, characterized by six nearest neighbor nitrogen atoms around the iron. What's interesting about this system is that it has two competing ground states, a low spin state in which all the electrons are paired in the T2G levels, and a high spin state where two of the electrons are promoted now to the upper EG levels. So you have a spin change of two in this system. And then you can actually interconvert between the low spin and high spin states through application of pressure, through chemical substitution. And in our case, we're particularly interested in optical excitation from this low spin state to a metal to ligand charge transfer state. So you're transferring charge on an ultrafast timescale from the iron to one of the nitrogens and the associated pyridyl ligands. And what people have observed from the optical spectroscopy is that on a very fast timescale, a few hundred femtoseconds, the system interconverts to this high spin state. So it's a remarkably fast spin interconversion time, suggesting that there's additional structural motion that must be happening on this sort of time scale that somehow must facilitate this spin transition and take up the change in total angular momentum. It's also known that people can trap this high spin state at low temperature, and so they've done structural studies, and they know between the low spin state and the high spin state, there's about a 10 to 15% change in this iron to nitrogen bond distance. So it's an interesting system where this ligand field strength, this 10dQ, is on the order of electron pairing energy. We want to try to understand, as I mentioned, this relationship between the electronic structure and the spin and magnetic properties. And in particular, do these structural distortions actually facilitate this spin crossover transition? This is sort of a model compound that's really relevant to understanding electron transfer in a wide variety of materials. It's of some practical interest by a number of groups for molecular electronics and optomagnetic storage materials. These transition metal complexes are also relevant for a wide range of light harvesting complexes, metallic proteins, and so on. I'll talk later in the second part of my talk about complex oxides, where the same sort of interaction between a transition metal d-electrons and the crystal field give rise to exotic and novel properties in extended solids. So just a quick comment on some earlier studies that were done in our group by Munir Khalil, where she was able to actually observe this change in the iron to nitrogen bond distance evolving on a 70 picosecond timescale using time-resolved XAPS techniques. More recently, experiments have been extended at the Swiss Light Source, and they've observed this pushed this time resolution down to about 200 femtoseconds. But from the XAPS measurements, you can directly discern this change in the iron to nitrogen bond distance using this sort of pump probe technique, exciting the metal to ligand charge transfer band, and probing with, in this case, picosecond X-ray pulses tunable above the iron K edge and inverting the XAPS structure. I'm going to focus more on electronic structure in these spin crossover compounds, and in particular, the relationship between charge transfer, the ligand bonding that I just briefly described, and the spin state of the system. And of course, a powerful approach for looking at electronic structure is L-edge spectroscopy, looking at the near edge. We can get direct information about the metal ligand bonding and its influence or relationship between the high spin and low spin states. And in particular, we're interested in the hybridization or the coupling of the iron 3D electrons and the 2P electrons of the ligands. And a useful approach to do this is to look at these near-edge spectroscopy at the iron L edge, where you're directly probing the 3D electrons, the ligand field split 3D electrons, from the spin orbit split iron 2P states. And so this gives you some direct information about this structure. And we want to do these in solution. Of course, our goal in the future is to really look at the influence of the solvent environment on this sort of reaction. So this is just an absorption spectrum at the iron L edge of these systems. And in fact, this is really one of the first absorption spectra taken of a solution phase of solvated molecules. shown here. And for comparison, this is some earlier measurements of a related compound. And this is using a powdered system, so it's not in solution, but you can at least see the general agreement with what people have observed before. So I mentioned that these are some of the first measurements done in liquids, and the challenge here, of course, in the soft X-ray range is that the absorption cross-sections are very high. And so not only do the experiments need to be done in vacuum, but you need to work with systems where the liquid is submicron in thickness. So these experiments are done in a cell that's been constructed using silicon nitride windows, and a number of groups have used this sort of approach. In our case, we're balancing the pressure in the vacuum chamber to achieve interferometric control of the sample thickness. So you can see these interferograms. You can actually control the sample thickness sort of on a fraction of a micron scale, so you can match the X-ray transmission with the optical absorption cross-section. And of course, we're exciting here at around 560 nanometers in this metal-to-ligand charge transfer band, and observing the L-edge, changes in the L-edge spectra in these molecules. So here's one of the first measurements of the differential spectra now. So we're looking at the change in absorption between the low spin state and the optically excited state following the excitation of the metal-to-ligand charge transfer band. And you see dramatic changes both at the L3 and the L2 edge. You see sort of a characteristic differential signature that suggests a shifting of these absorption edges. A few things to point out. One is that if you integrate the differential spectra, it integrates essentially to zero, which means that there's no net change in valency of the iron. And you have a net shift, this is maybe not so obvious here, a net shift of spectral weight from the iron L2 to the iron L3, which is a characteristic signature of the high spin state. I'm also showing here in solid measurements again done on a powdered sample where people have trapped the high spin state, and you can see that there's at least qualitative agreement with what people have observed before. So we're seeing the first evidence of this change in the ligand field parameter, this 10dQ, shifting of the spectral weight that I mentioned, and we can observe how this evolves, at least in these initial measurements, on a 70 picosecond time scale, probing directly at the iron L3 edge and watching the evolution, and at the iron L2 edge. So from these kinds of spectra, actually, now you can reconstruct the transient spectra of the high spin state, the photoexcited high spin state. And that's what's been done here. So here we're looking at the absorption spectra again, the low spin state that I showed you before, iron L3 and the L2 edge. And now the high spin state, the spectra that's been captured, in this case at a delay of 90 picoseconds following the excitation. So you see essentially the same sort of features that I described before in the differential spectra, a strong shifting of the L3 edge by more than 1.5 eV, and a somewhat smaller shifting of the L2 edge. And you see a substantial reshaping of the L2 absorption edge, and similar in the L3 edge. And these are sort of characteristic of multiple splitting, and although these look like noise, there's actually rich information contained in these spectra. So let me describe a little bit about how we attempt to understand what's going on in these spectra. First, we start with a model compound. So this is a different system with TACN ligands that has a low spin spectra that's very similar to what we've observed in our compounds. One important difference is in this model compound, there's no pi back bonding. So I'll say a little bit more about that later, but essentially the pi back bonding means that you're drawing the 3D electrons of the iron into the pi star antibonding orbitals of the ligand. So in this case, there's no pi back bonding, but if you sort of account for that, it's effectively a shift toward the blue, and you get a spectra that's very similar to what we observe. For the high spin model compound, we've looked at iron hexachloride, which is a naturally high spin system, and you see the spectra, absorption spectra at the L3 and L2 is very reminiscent of what I showed earlier in our transient measurements. Importantly, people have done multiple calculations to model these spectra, and you can actually model them quite accurately using this multiple theory, taking into account correlation effects. And so we've now collaborated with Frank de Groot, and he's applied the same sort of techniques to understand our compound. So this is the spectra that I showed you before, the low spin and the transient high spin at 90 picoseconds, and the charge transfer multiple calculations that actually fit the spectra quite well, even some of the more subtle features. And so what can you learn from this sort of analysis of the data? Several things, and I mentioned this 1.7 eV shifting of the L3 edge. To first order, you might think, well, that's the change in the ligand field splitting. In fact, if you account for core hole effects, the change in the ligand field splitting amounts to about 1.2 eV. So about a half an eV of this is from core hole effects. Several other features that come out from this sort of fitting is that there's an opposite change in covalency for the T2G and the EG levels. The EG are losing electrons and the T2G are gaining electrons. We see a substantial reduction in this pi back bonding. So in the high spin state, pi back bonding is suppressed. 3D electrons that have been drawn from the iron into the pi star antibonding orbitals of the ligands in the high field, in the high spin state, they're drawn back into the iron core and have much more metal character. They see some effects of reduced spin orbit interaction from the iron 3D, and they think that this is accounting for the reshaping of the L2 edge. And they observe evidence of larger exchange interaction between the iron 3D and the 2P, and that accounts for this change in splitting between the first peak and this first multiplet. In the high spin state, you see the larger splitting here, and in the low spin, a smaller splitting. So you can actually get a fair amount of information from these kinds of studies, and we're now in the process of extending these into the sub-picosecond time range. And so this is one of the first snapshots of this differential spectra that I showed earlier at 90 picoseconds, now at 700 femtoseconds delay. And the essential features at the L3 edge are reproduced. And of course, you can follow this in time with a resolution of about 200 femtoseconds. And you can see these changes during the course of the spin crossover transition. Of course, ideally, you'd want to push this resolution even further so that you can actually observe these changes on timescales faster than the transitions occurring. Here we have resolution that's somewhat comparable to the timescales of this transition. Let me jump now to the second topic, which is somewhat related in that it's also has interesting materials with interesting phenomena resulting from transition metal oxides and the crystal field, in this case, colossal magnetoresistive manganites. So let me give a just kind of a quick introduction. Of course, here we're interested in the system because of the strong coupling between charge, orbital, and lattice degrees of freedom. And this sort of coupling gives rise to competing ground states and exotic properties. Of course, it's related to materials that give rise to high-temperature superconductivity. In this case, where the properties of interest are colossal magnetoresistance, the fact that you can actually change the conductivity of the material by many orders of magnitude, 7 to 10 orders of magnitude, by the application of a relatively modest magnetic field. And of course, we want to apply ultrafast measurements in combination with X-rays to understand these correlation effects as they're developing. So just a quick description of these. So of course, these systems are of interest because you can apply magnetic control of the electronic structure, magnetotransport effects being the dominant mechanism. They have a very rich phase diagram that results from order and symmetry breaking effects. So essentially, these are cubic perovskite compounds with a manganese center and an octahedral crystal field of oxygen. When you dope these systems with alkyne atoms, you get a orthorhombic distortion of this perovskite, this cubic perovskite. And so you have this sort of distortion that you can see here, this tilting of these oxygen octahedra. And this gives rise to a very rich electronic phase diagram. So as a function of temperature and doping, you have all sorts of ordering phenomena occurring, charge ordering, phenomena, cantidad antiferromagnetic ordering, and of course insulating states here, and these states here are metallic. These states are insulating at all temperatures. An important point is that with the application of a magnetic field, you can change the resistivity by many orders of magnitude, and you can see this here. So one way to understand this, of course, with the crystal field, you have splitting of the manganese 3D levels. You have localization in the insulating state of these single electrons on manganese sites of alternate valency. And this localization is enhanced by Jahn-Teller instability. When you apply the magnetic field, of course, you change the hopping probability And the way this is, at least one way that this is understood, is through a double exchange mechanism where you have simultaneous hopping of electrons from manganese sites to adjacent manganese sites through the neighboring oxygens. This is again observed through the application of a magnetic field. People have also observed these phase transitions through the application of pressure. What I'm going to talk about is the observation of these fields, of these effects through optical excitation and through coherent vibrational excitation of a manganese oxygen stretching mode. So the idea, one way to understand, I mentioned this orthorhombic distortion of this cubic perovskite structure. One way to characterize this distortion is through the tolerance factor. And so this is essentially determined by, the tolerance factor is essentially describes the ability of the electrons to hop with a smaller tolerance factor corresponding to greater charge localization. In our case, we're interested in this term here in the tolerance factor, which is the distance between the manganese and the neighboring oxygen. And this can, by controlling this bond distance, in principle, you should be able to change the electron hopping rate. And at least in this case, we want to induce the phase transition in the electronic ground state by controlling this. So this is showing the optical conductivity of this material with a gap at about 0.3 eV. And well below the gap, you see the relevant infrared active modes, the manganese oxygen bending mode and the manganese oxygen stretching mode, which is the one that we're going to target at about 17 microns wavelength. This is shows a generalized phase diagram of different compounds. By changing the element composition, you can control this tolerance factor. In our case, we want to control this tolerance factor in a dynamic way by manipulating this bond distance, directly exciting the manganese oxygen stretch, and hopefully inducing this insulator to metal transition. So we've been able to do that. I'll just describe these experiments very quickly. Pumping the system now with coherent mid-infrared pulses, again at 17 microns, and doing just simple conductivity measurements, you can see changes in conductivity of many orders of magnitude. These are just electronic measurements, so the time resolution is a few nanoseconds. But we only observe these effects when the excitation is resonant with the manganese oxygen stretch, and it's not observed as you tune off resonance in either direction. Of course, for higher time resolution, you need to use optical probes, and this is just a quick summary of the various optical probes looking at the reflectivity of the sample now as a way to understand the insulator to metal transition. And we see characteristic signatures in the differential reflectivity on a sort of 100 to 200 femtosecond time scale, suggesting the metallic state is formed on that kind of time scale. And again, these effects are only observed when you're probing, when you're exciting the system on resonance of this manganese oxygen stretch. And the effect is not observed when you're tuning off resonance. It also has a well-defined fluence threshold and saturation, which is again characteristic of a phase transition. So this in itself is very interesting, that you can actually control these correlated electronic phases in the electronic ground state by coherent vibrational excitation. And we see these large changes in resistivity, but they really raise maybe more questions than they answer. And these are questions really where X-rays now can have a huge impact in trying to address, in particular, the crystallographic distortion that's associated with these phase transitions. You can imagine applying ultrafast X-ray diffraction or XF techniques to understand this. We're not able to understand anything currently about the magnetic nature of this phase transition. It's the metallic phase that we think we're creating. Is this ferromagnetic? So X-ray dichroism measurements can play an important role here. Two things that I want to describe that we're working on now. One is using ultrafast X-ray absorption spectroscopy to understand how the hybridization of the manganese 3D and the oxygen 2P changed during the course of this phase transition. And so this gives us at least some information about electron localization and delocalization. And we're now starting to work on ultrafast resonant X-ray diffraction to understand the changes in the charge, orbital, and spin ordering that occurs in this material and how this is evolving during the course of this phase transition. So just a quick description of the X-ray absorption spectroscopy that we're doing. This is, again, in the PCMO with 0.3 doping. And here, previous synchrotron studies have shown that particularly at the oxygen K edge, you're very sensitive to the manganese 3D electrons, and it's a very effective probe of these manganese 3D states. So again, you're probing these states from the spin orbit split manganese 2P levels, and that's what we're going to focus on for our initial experiments. So this is a one of the first differential absorption measurements. In this case, these are relatively thick solid samples, and so we're not measuring the absorption in transmission mode, but rather we're looking at total electron yield. And for these early measurements, we're not doing the vibrational pumping, we're doing the optical excitation, but that also induces the phase transition. And so these are showing measurements at the oxygen K edge in the near edge region with the laser on and the laser off, and we see a pronounced change and a shifting of spectral weight toward lower energies. And this is the differential absorption spectrum in the pre-edge region of the oxygen. And of course, we can start to follow this now in time as a metallic state is formed. And these are measurements done now just within the 70 picosecond resolution of the synchrotron pulse, again, probing it in the pre-edge region at 532. And so we start to see, again, the dynamic shift of the density of state spectral weight toward the absorption threshold as sort of a first order indication of changes in the manganese 3D oxygen 2P hybridization and changes in the crystal field splitting associated with this phase transition and relaxation of the Jahn-Teller distortions. How do we understand this shift in the spectral weight? Well, to first order, we can compare this to related compounds, related manganites, where you can actually access the metallic phase at elevated temperatures. That's not the case in PCMO. This remains insulating at all temperatures. But in these related manganites, people have done static measurements at elevated temperatures and looked at thermally induced metallic phase and see the same sort of shift of spectral weight. You see the same differential spectral signatures that we observe in PCMO in these compounds. And so that's sort of the first order comparison that this is actually a clear signature of the formation of the metallic state. More recently, we've been able to make direct comparisons of what we're observing in this transient regime to the magnetic state, the metallic state that's induced by application of magnetic field. And of course, that's really the hallmark of these colossal magnetoresistive compounds, is that you can create the metallic state by application of a magnetic field. So these are experiments that were done at the APS. And so you can see the spectra under zero field in black, and with the application of a 2 Tesla field, the formation of the metallic state, in very close agreement with what we're observing in the photo-induced regime on a picosecond time scale. And again, the differential spectra shown here at 2, 4, and 6 Tesla applied fields agree quite well with our early measurements. So this is sort of the first indication that, in fact, this photo-induced state we're creating is, in fact, if not identical, very closely related to the metallic state that's created by the CMR effect. So we're just now in the process of trying to extend these kinds of measurements really to the timescale of interest, the sort of sub-picosecond and a few hundred femtosecond timescale. I'm just about out of time, so I'll just mention quickly some experiments that are also in progress where we want to look at the charge and orbital ordering behavior in these compounds and how this is evolving during the course of these phase transitions. And here we're applying time-resolved resonant X-ray diffraction. And so here we're looking at Bragg peaks that are nominally forbidden by the lattice symmetry, but the charge and orbital ordering break that symmetry and allow diffraction peaks at absorption resonances. So in particular, we're looking at a quarter zero peak that results from charge and orbital ordering at the manganese L edge. So this is in half-doped compounds where you have a regular ordering of charges and an ordering of orbitals that it follows sort of a zigzag pattern. This is the scattering geometry. So the C-axis is here. X-rays are coming in from this direction with P polarization. And we can actually rotate the sample azimuthally and extract some important information. This is just a characteristic resonant diffraction peak. On resonance, you see a strong enhancement of the diffraction, and off resonance, the diffraction is essentially gone. What's particularly interesting is if you look at the resonant diffraction spectra, tuning the X-ray energy and staying on the resonant diffraction peak, it can essentially map out the diffraction spectra. And that's what's shown here in red and in blue for two different dopings. And what's striking about this is that these spectra differ markedly from the nominal absorption spectra of the sample that you can measure using total fluorescence yield, shown in the dashed lines. So this is something that that we're looking into right now and are very interested by, because it gives you sort of an indication that the charges that are responsible for the ordering phenomena are not the same, or that they differ in important ways from the valence charges that give rise to the absorption spectra. You can also get important information by looking at these diffraction peaks at the L3 edge and at the L2 edge as a function of azimuthal angle. That gives you relative sensitivity to spin and orbital order. And this is just sort of a compilation of some of this data now. These are just static measurements at different temperatures, and you see the peak goes away as you go above the transition temperature. Depending on whether you're looking at L3, you see evidence of orbital ordering behavior consistent with the phase transition of the diagrams that I showed earlier. Interestingly, at L2, we think we're starting to see changes in the antiferromagnetic ordering that seem to be sensitive to this azimuthal angle that I described. We have now some preliminary time-resolved measurements on a picosecond time scale, and we're in the process of actually trying to extend this to the femtosecond time domain using the short X-ray pulses. So since I'm out of time, let me wrap up quickly. I've described two systems that we're looking at using ultrafast X-ray spectroscopy to look at structural dynamics in solvated transition metal compounds, where there's a strong coupling between ligand field and the molecular structure and the electronic properties, using time-resolved near-edge spectroscopy. We've applied a number of techniques to look at colossal magnetic resistive manganites, also transition metal complexes. We've been able to show terahertz vibrational control of these correlated electronic phases. And we're now applying X-ray techniques, near-edge absorption spectroscopy, and resonant X-ray diffraction to try to understand the changes in electronic structure. And just as a final comment, I'm reminded of our charge. I don't know if anybody remembers this from the invitation to this great workshop, that I guess the purpose of these talks is really to sort of inspire and focus the theory discussions during the weeks that follow the conference. This is a very tall order, so I'm not sure that I've done any of that, but I can at least make maybe a few sort of obvious comments about theory. Certainly in the area of molecules, there's a real need to understand in some quantitative way the excited state dynamics, particularly in this for non-adiabatic potential energy surfaces. And I think we'll hear more talks about this from Todd Martinez and others. In the correlated materials, of course, there's a real challenge to understand this coupling between atomic and electronic structure. We're trying to advance this process by looking at systems in the electronic ground state. Of course, systems where you're dumping in an EV and half or more of energy in photoexcited carriers, this makes the problem even more intractable. So there's some advantages to being able to manipulate these systems in electronic ground state and hopefully have more direct coupling with theory. And of course, there's a real need to have a direct connection between these X-ray probes and the electronic structure. In the case of the solvated molecules, the multiplet model seemed to work quite well and was very effective, but I think that's maybe sort of a limited example. And let me just acknowledge all of the people that have done the work that I've described. Shen Zhao, Yi Zhu, Matt Lagner did all the measurements in the correlated materials with a substantial work from Yide Chang at the Advanced Light Source. Niels Hus and graduate student Hannah Cho and a new postdoc, Matt Strader, have worked on the solvated transition metal complexes with an important theory collaboration with Frank de Groot. And let me thank you for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Great talk. Questions?
Oh, I just was wondering if anybody knows what a 1.5 EV photon pulse does to push this thing into a ferromagnetic state. Does anyone have a guess as to what? Let me just say, it's clear it's not just heating up the sample, because
no,
it's make
not
it more insulating.
It's not heating.
It's doing
the sample.
Something non-trivial.
That's right. No, that's a good question. And there have been actually, I don't have slides here, but our collaborators have done a number of studies. There's some suggestion that you're seeing impulsive Raman excitation because they see evidence of what they're calling orbital waves being excited in the material. And they're seeing this at frequencies that are substantially higher than any of the known modes of the system. you also can think of this in terms of a charge transfer excitation and essentially moving localized charges from one manganese site to adjacent sites. But these are not adequate explanations by any means. And that's part of the reason why we focused on trying to manipulate these materials in the electronic ground state, where you're not creating free carriers and you're not creating these charges. So the experiments that I described, really the goal is to apply the coherent mid-infrared excitation to create the metallic state and observe these correlated properties without all of these excess carriers.
So I have a question about the oxygen KH spectra that you showed. I'm just trying to understand the way you label the peaks, because there were peaks that you called, for example, manganese. I mean, it's not like you can excite an oxygen 1s electron and make it hop over to the manganese. It's probably more some kind of orbital mixing that you have in mind. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry.
I mean, because you're labeling these near edge lines in terms of other elements.
Oh,
I mean,
these are all transitions. Yeah, I'm just indicating that this transition is particularly sensitive to the distribution of the manganese 3D electrons.
Uh-huh. So it's some kind of orbital mixing effect.
Yes.
There's an indirect effect of the neighboring atoms on the oxygen.
And surprisingly, it's more sensitive at the oxygen K edge than if you look at the manganese L edge. And there have been a number of synchrotron studies that have shown this. Nothing time resolved. These are just sort of high resolution measurements under different magnetic fields. And you can actually see changes in the manganese 3D distribution by looking at the oxygen K edge. So it's sort of counterintuitive in that sense. And I think you're right. It's a consequence of the hybridization. But that's really what we're after. We're after this hybridization. And this just turns out to be the most effective place to probe it. Mm-hmm.
So in one of your slides, you were saying about the perspectives for future measurements, and it was just a kind of a dynamic band structure. Would you like just to comment more on that?
This slide?
Yeah.
And your question is?
Just more details.
More details about these. So of course, we expect that there's some structural distortion associated with these phase transitions. And so the two techniques that you can imagine applying, and in fact, people are now doing this, ultrafast X-ray diffraction techniques to look at these, at the crystal changes in the crystallographic structure associated with the phase transition. Henry showed earlier in this meeting, and there are a number of other groups that are applying X-ray dichroism techniques to look at magnetic phase transitions and separate out spin and orbital contributions to the net magnetic moment. Of course, we expect that there are magnetic phase transitions occurring in this material as well, and so these will be important techniques. This requires circularly polarized X-rays, ideally, and in fact, we have an upgrade to the beamline coming next year that should make these sorts of measurements possible. I mentioned already the resonant diffraction techniques, where it's really a spectroscopy technique. You're looking at the diffraction at a specific absorption edge, and this is very useful for looking at long-range ordering of charge and orbits. I think Brian Stevenson will be talking about photon correlation spectroscopy, which is also a very powerful technique for looking at phase separation at the nanoscale in systems that don't have long-range order. So applying this on the ultrafast timescale is a challenge, but I think will be very fruitful. And then I just described in the case of absorption spectroscopy, this is sort of the simplest thing you can apply, and that's what we're trying to do now, with getting some useful information, but it's maybe not the most informative compared to some of these other techniques. So these are things that are all sort of being developed, and with next generation light sources coming online, free electron lasers in the soft X-ray range that have the sort of tunability and control that are required, I think these sort of techniques will really take off.
So one thing I always wonder about when I see this talk is the actual details of this spin flip, this enormous change in the metal after the metal leading charge transfer in this transition metal center complexes. So you mentioned briefly that there's indications that a
some structural dynamics apparently are involved in this. Is there? But in one of your view graphs, there was also some schematic of an intermediate state between the metal leading charge transfer and the high spin state. Is there anything known beyond that? Yes, exactly.
This sort of dotted line just sort of suggests that we really have no idea what the heck's going on in that ring. people have proposed multiple conical intersections to describe this. But trying to get quantitative information from optical spectroscopy measurements, this is really a. But there are some very nice measurements from Majaturgi's group where he's looking at absorption in the UV, where he claims to see some evidence of this initial transitions between some of these intermediate states. But we're a long way from quantifying them in any real sense.
And do you think that X-ray techniques rather than optical techniques are more promising to highlight these kind of subtle changes?
I think they're much more informative. I mean, even the simple spectroscopy techniques that we're applying, you can already start to say something more quantitative about the degree of coupling and hybridization between the iron 3D and the nitrogen 2P. The optical spectra are just sort of these diffuse. So ultimately, you'd really like to be able to apply inelastic X-ray scattering techniques and eventually multidimensional spectroscopy of the sort that Shaw talked about yesterday to these kinds of systems.
Actually, also a question to this system. I mean, on this 300 femtosecond timescale, you have a huge change in angular momentum. And what are the ideas about sort of how to conserve angular momentum in this transition? I mean, do you think about orbital momentum, increase in orbital momentum, or decrease in orbital momentum, which is accompanying this? Or
that's a good question, and similar questions have been raised in condensed matter solids, right, where people see very rapid demagnetization on timescales that are not necessarily consistent with the sort of Einstein de Haas effects. And certainly there is a change in the ligands are dilating, so there is structural motion going on. There's some evidence that there's some trigonal distortion of these cages. What you'd really like to do is be able to take corresponding snapshots of the atomic structure at the same time that you're looking at the electronic structure to maybe get a handle on this. I think it's a good question that we're taking sort of preliminary steps toward addressing. But where is this angular momentum going, and how is it enabling the sort of spin transition on this kind of time scale? No, it's not. It's in a liquid, so the whole thing could spin. No, this is in the liquid phase. Hand it off to.
Well, I mean, if it was in a solid, then
you could. Not in a
you
solid.
Can give. But even if it's in a.
There
liquid,
are isolated molecules.
But not in vacuum.
They're not in vacuum.
They're in a liquid.
No, so there may be coupling to the solvent environment. Absolutely.
Just.
And there are many modes there to couple to. So this is a yes. But that's part of the motivation for trying to look at these in solution and understand the influence of the solvent, because this is.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking from the other perspective. If you tried to say there was conservation of angular momentum, it'd be shocking, right? Because there are all these places for it to go. It was just an academic point, so.
Well taken.
Anything else? There's no more comments or questions. Let's thank Bob again.
Great.
And welcome Steve Leone from UC Berkeley and the Berkeley Lab, who will present us the latest results about X-ray transient absorption, how to reach the attosecond limit.